Hi, and welcome to the 24th edition of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm John Neff.
And I'm Chris Paukert.
And today we're, as always, going to go over some of the most interesting stuff in the automotive industry that's happened in the past week or so, or however long it's been since we did episode number 23. And for whatever reason today, it's turned out that all three of our topics are going to be on SUV, CUV type vehicles. So we're going to touch on the 2006 Land Rover, Range Rover Sport that we had in the Autoblog garage. And we're also going to go over the Ford Bronco revival, which is shaping up to be yet another revival vehicle from Ford that throws a little retro in there. And then
we'll put quotes on the revival, I think.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about what we think this is going to mean.
Yeah.
And then finally, we're going to end with the Lotus APX concept that's going to debut in Geneva because we think it's a pretty cool idea. So let's get right into it and talk about the Range Rover Sport that we had. And this is kind of unusual because normally when a vehicle is in the Autoblog garage, only one of us gets to drive it and review it. But since Chris and I live it within spitting distance of each other, we actually both got to drive it. He had it for most of the week that it was in the garage, and I got to take it on a trip to Cincinnati and spend some highway miles with it. So what did you think of it?
I think it's an interesting vehicle. I think, you know, it's definitely got some strong points behind it. First off, it looks fantastic, and as people saw from the three-part review, I think it drives really well on the highway and has some nice things that it offers, but I think it's sort of an example of what happens when you have a small lineup and you try and slice it up so many different ways using a lot of the same, you know, platform and drivetrain bits, and the picture gets a little bit muddy, especially considering how much, you know, this vehicle takes from the LR3, the Discovery replacement, underneath it. It's kind of an odd duck. What did you think?
It is an odd duck in the sense that you can't even call it a niche vehicle because Land Rover is almost a niche company, you know. But it's like a niche vehicle within a niche brand. I'll tell you what I didn't like about it first. There was a lot of interior trouble going on.
A lot of bells and whistles.
Yeah, literally. I mean, it's the exact opposite. It's the antithesis of the BMW iDrive, where in that car it's one input device for everything. In this car, everything gets its own button. Like, there are just buttons everywhere. And not only that, but there are chimes for everything. And I could count on my hand how many times something chimed, and I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know why it was going off.
Like, I think that was the parking distance control thing, the sensors in the front and rear bumpers.
It could have been, but then there'd be times where I was on the highway and it would start beeping, and I was like, the gas is fine, I have plenty of gas.
Apparently you're tailgating people really, really closely.
That's perfectly possible. It could have been that, which would have been crazy. You'd think it would only come on at, you know, below a certain speed, but because that'd be funny if you were like about to hit a telephone pole at 90 miles an hour, is the last thing you'd hear is like the sensor warning going off.
Well, I heard that thing in my sleep.
Yeah, so I mean there are a lot of these kind of niggles that I hate to, you know, knock a vehicle down for, but it's the thing that you come, you know, you deal with every day. I don't look at the car more than I look at the interior, you know.
And as soon as I got into it, I was hitting the parking distance control button to turn it off away.
Exactly, which tells you something. You know,
yeah,
it's a nice feature, but if you can't integrate it where I don't have to deal with it, then you might as well not put it in. Having said that, having, you know, the nav system was a little bit difficult to get the hang of. Those are all things that over time will become, you know, second nature to somebody who owns the vehicle. So that's
true.
Why,
but these are adjustments that people probably really shouldn't have to make.
True, but when it's a luxury vehicle, you got to throw everything in it. You know, I think that's what's in their head is that, well, it's got to have a nav system, it's got to have the sensors in the back and the front, mm-hmm. it's got to have the seat warmers, it's got to have the, you know, I mean, basically they just throw everything in it, and then suddenly, like we said, they don't have an iDrive type thing that integrates everything. So you're looking at the front, you're looking at the dash, and there's just it's just buttons all over the place.
Well, with the exception of All the four-wheel drive stuff, all the
That's the
hill descent
exception.
control, the terrain response and stuff like that. I'm fine with all of that stuff having its own, buttonry because you don't really use that in daily driving so much.
Well, and it simplified it. I mean,
Yeah, and
that was
that
the
was
only the in terms of ergonomics, I thought that was outstanding because I remember, back in the day, if I'd hop in something four-wheel drive and it had buttons, I'm like, I don't know at what point I'm allowed to hit that button to go into, four-wheel low
Right.
or, but this was just a knob and you turn it to whatever, situation you're in, whether it's snow or sand and hill descent was an obvious one. I would say that was the best part of the interior in terms of how you deal with it, how you interact with it.
No,
But it.
I agree with you. I think, the whole center console outside of that is kind of a mess. And the nav system in particular. The one thing I would say is there are vehicles on the market that have all of these features, save the all-wheel or save the four-wheel drive gubbins that do this better.
Yes.
And as simply as the Honda Pilot that has rear seat entertainment, that has the nav system.
Oh, that was a bear. Did you try to put a DVD in and play it? I got it
Yeah,
to
I
do it,
did.
but it took us about maybe an hour, the manual out. It took me like a half hour to find out where
Well, the
the
manual is like a Franklin planner that's like 3 inches thick, or manuals, I should say.
Yeah, seriously. It took me forever to find out that it was in the rear of the vehicle, and I had to pop off a panel and like look in the wheel well to find the DVD changer.
Right, pull the wiring nests away. Yeah, no,
Right,
I mean you
right.
saw that in my post. I think we shouldn't be too hard on this vehicle. There are some really great things about it, but the bottom line is most of those great things also apply to the LR3, which is about $13,000 less as I figured it.
Yeah, but all right. All right, let's talk about some good things. For one, the seats were awesome.
And the seat heaters,
Yeah.
you could cook an egg on those things.
On a 3 hour drive to Cincinnati from Cleveland, I felt when I was done with the road trip, I felt like I could have done it two more times in a row.
You probably could have. The it's easy on the highway.
Yeah, very, very just wonderful cruiser. The styling I think is excellent.
I agree.
Also that the handling is just downright surprising. It stayed remarkably flat, and this doesn't even have the trick anti-sway bars that lock in and out like the supercharged version does. But even still, it was remarkably composed for such a heavy vehicle, which this is an extremely heavy vehicle.
Yeah, and one of our readers pointed out, you didn't really make the case for the vehicle over, a similar crossover. And, the honest answer is I didn't do that on purpose because I'm not sure I can.
Well,
But
what do
I
they
don't
mean by that? Like, what?
I
Give an
think they mean
example of
versus
what
like
crossover.
a car-based vehicle like the Infiniti FX, for example, which is it is probably still it's definitely handles better on road. And obviously, it doesn't have anything really in the way of off-road capability. But I think that's, we're dealing with horses for courses here. And I didn't make that comparison because that's something that the consumer will do on their own.
Well, and there's this idea of the intangible Land Roverness of something as well. I could get an Infiniti for maybe $20,000 less, but it's not a Land Rover and it's not going to impress my neighbor as much.
Yeah.
So I do think that when you're talking about price, that comes into it. And with this vehicle in particular, even though you could get an LR3 for much less, there's something about a Range Rover Sport that is so niche that, there's a premium on it.
Yeah, it's the styling and it's the badge, the association with Range Rover, which another of our readers said, he was involved in some sort of a clinic and was upset that they were sort of downgrading the brand by associating it with the Range Rover. And there, there may be something to be said for that. It's interesting.
But I, a lot of people say I'd rather have an LR3, and quite frankly, I wouldn't. The LR3 is much more utilitarian in my view, not only in its styling, but and I haven't driven one, so I can't say this for certain. But I don't think it would be as much of a driver's SUV as the Range Rover Sport.
Well, I think, it's jacked up a little bit higher in the air, but you're still dealing with a vehicle where you can get the same drivetrain. You can get the same off-road ability, albeit with this, longer wheelbase. But you're dealing with the same 4.4 liter V8, with the same amount of, power. You've got more space in it, a couple of extra seats. I still like the styling on it too. It's got kind of that sub-zero fridge of the SUV world look. Just
Yes.
very, very clean, very minimalist.
See, I like the Range Rover Sport styling a little better, but
I
that's
do
all
too,
personal
but you know,
taste.
I don't know if I like it $13,000 better.
Yeah, but whenever you make a sport model of something in your lineup, you always charge a premium for it. And but when you get when you when you're when the base vehicle you're using is costs as much as an LR3 does, that gets jacked up percentage-wise to something around 13,000. Now, this isn't a sport version of the LR3; it is its own model. But I don't think they're out of line asking for that much. I don't think they're
I think the market is proving that they're not at all out of line.
exactly.
I'm just saying from a personal standpoint, it's their number one selling vehicle right now. It's the thing that's responsible for their largest amount of growth, which you would kind of figure because it's a brand new model. I look at this as the Range Rover, the Sport being sport equals light in terms of cost. In that they're trying to associate it in terms of styling and badge. With the top end Range Rover, it's sort of the way, if you remember the Mitsubishi Montero and the Mitsubishi Montero Sport, where the Sport was less expensive and a bit less capable all the way around, and Sport was kind of the almost, I don't want to say a discount badge because that's the wrong word to be using here, but the less expensive version.
Well, I would really like to see the Range Rover Sport get some more development dollars, so it wasn't viewed, at least by people in the know, as kind of cobbled together from parts of the LR3 and the Ford parts bin. I'd like to see it kind of grow as its own model, and I think with as much as it's selling, it probably that's in the plans.
No, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm glad they brought it to market anyway. I don't think it's a bad vehicle. I definitely wouldn't say that. I just think it's hard to make a case for and as a consumer that is aware of everything else that's going on in the marketplace, including within Rover's own showroom.
Yeah, it's tough because I'm so far away from being a Land Rover customer that when I review a vehicle like this, I have to imagine if I had, an income that was, over $1 million, would this be something I would look at?
If you had an income over $1 million, you'd probably be looking at the Range Rover. This would be the thing for your kid, maybe.
All right. Well, on that note, let's move to another SUV. This Ford, and I don't know where you found this on the internet. I was totally surprised when I saw that you had posted this.
I'm still surprised that nobody else has picked this
Why
up
isn't anybody
story-wise.
talking about it? This was just on, we found it on Inside Line,
Yeah.
and it was just this little article. It wasn't even about Ford bringing back the Bronco. It was really about the Dodge Hornet, which is going to be unveiled in Geneva, and they happened to throw in this little nugget about Ford bringing back the Bronco as a very entry level, what would we call it? It's not even really an SUV that it's coming back as.
No, it's. I think from the way it sounds, it's going to be as much an SUV as, say, a Honda Element is, except at a cheaper price.
Well, they make it sound like it's going to be as much of an SUV as a Scion XB, which is not an SUV at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to have. All right, let's go over the info we have. It's going to. They want it to start under $10,000,
Which
which.
is unbelievable. But
Right.
let's bear in mind too that this is. Yeah, I mean they're reporting it as fact. So
Yeah.
that's all we can go on. And Edmunds is usually a very good source of information. But that said, it's very curious that nobody else has picked up on this story yet.
Right, and it's going to be built on the current generation Ford Fiesta platform. And
Yeah.
that's going to be down in Ford of Mexico's, I can't even pronounce the plant name. I don't even want to try. It's going to be
Quetzaltenango or
built,
something, yeah.
yeah. It's going to be built in Mexico, on the current Fiesta platform. Even though there's a new generation Fiesta platform being developed by Mazda in Japan, but
The
that.
good news is everything I understand about the Fiesta is that it's a pretty good vehicle.
Well, we always say we want more stuff from foreign markets, so.
Yeah.
But the real question is, and this is what you posed in the post, is. The Bronco's image, its reputation is one of an extreme off-roader, not a soft roader sub $10,000 Scion fighter. And the question is Ford making a mistake by bringing the name back and slapping it on the side of a sub $10,000 kind of like Econobox is really, I guess, what it's going to be.
I don't even know that they can do all-wheel drive in this thing, to be honest with
Not
you.
under 10,000.
Yeah,
That'd be insane. So it's going to be front wheel drive. I would say it's a bad idea. I don't think the vehicle's a bad idea. I just don't know why you need to call it Bronco.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the concept was in back in 2004 was so gorgeous. I thought actually
Yeah.
it was my pick for best in show because it was really it showed its heritage, it respected it, the name's heritage. It looked like it had off-road ability at the time when I saw it. I wasn't aware that it was actually the EcoSport crossover underneath, which kind of gave me a case of the Ghiblies. But yeah, I thought maybe like a shortened Ranger platform, where body on frame stuff is dirt cheap and,
Right,
kind
right.
of a rough and tumble SUV would be fine. But I mean it's a few years later already and the Ranger isn't getting any younger, let's be
What?
honest.
No. Who knows what they're going to do with that and when, but something needs to happen fast. But with this Bronco, everybody knows a Bronco, am I wrong? I mean, women know the Bronco, men know the Bronco, young and old know the Bronco. And when you say the name, and I fear when this thing rolls up and you say, that's a Bronco, they're not going to put two and two together. And in this piece from Edmunds, it also mentions that the Bronco will have a sibling car, just like the Scion XB has the XA five-door hatchback, that this will have a five-door hatchback as well. So then this has me thinking that Ford is really aiming directly at Scion, that started this kind of strategy of having, two very entry-level products that were quirky and different. I really don't see. I mean, I think it's not a bad idea for Ford to have an entry-level product below, let's say, the Focus. That's not a problem, but I don't know. This we'll have to wait. We have no other information about this vehicle. I mean, I want to see what it looks like, for one thing.
Yeah, I kind of get the feeling, because if you look at the concept, the 2004 concept, there's no way you could get anywhere near it, even
No.
if all the metal stuff was replaced with plastic. I mean, the wheel and tire, the stance alone, is quite a bit of money, and there's no way it's going to look like this. I think
Well,
it's going to end up being, this is there are a lot of those, Japanese domestic market vehicles that sort of look like caricatures of other historical vehicles, like the smaller version of, the Jaguars of yore. And I can kind of see this turning into a little bit of a parody of itself, and I really hope I'm wrong. I just, for $10,000, even 15, I'm not really sure how you can do that. So I'm definitely,
I don't know how Ford can do a sub $10,000 car, period. I mean, that'll be a feat in itself.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I mean, I think it may be a neat vehicle. I don't know how you make money on something like this, and I don't know why you slap, the Bronco badge on it. And maybe, they'll do some like generic kind of heritage cues that sort of evoke the old ones, but that they won't end up calling it the Bronco. Maybe they'll clinic the name out of it, which could be a good thing here.
Well, let's say anybody who ends up in a clinic say you don't like the Bronco name. And hopefully it won't end up on it. All right. The last SUV in our little podcast today is the Lotus APX, which is very interesting. In the sense that we really didn't expect an SUV crossover type vehicle from Lotus to be unveiled at the Geneva show, but Lotus has already released official pics of it and a press release, and par for the course for Lotus is this vehicle's very lightweight. It comes in at about 3.5, under 3,500 pounds. Lots of aluminum used throughout.
That would be aluminium here.
Aluminium, yes, an aluminium skeleton. And the styling is basically it's a four-door crossover really, and it has normal seating for five. And then two seats in the very way back, which it doesn't really call a third row. How did they put it in their press release?
I believe they said occasional.
It's occasional. It's an
It's like
occasional
a, it's
seat.
a, yeah, it's like a 5+2. You remember the two
Yeah,
plus
five
twos where
plus
they
two.
were
Yeah.
basically for groceries? It's probably like for, the wee tots in the way back.
The engine looks way bigger than what Lotus normally uses. It's a 3-liter. Double overhead cam V6 that's supercharged makes 300 horsepower. So, with the weight of the vehicle, this thing can shoot to 60 in about 5 seconds, which is quicker than the Lotus Europa S.
That's
So,
the way it said, yeah.
I think the real curious thing is how close to production Lotus is making this vehicle seem.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable that one has to ask the cost question here, because to this point, doing this the aluminium bonding techniques and the the fastening and all of that, the extrusions isn't cheap, which is why not everybody's doing it now as it is. But they could make a go of this. I don't know if they're looking for a partner to do this. Rover, excuse me, Rover. I'm still back on the other thing. Lotus has long time, been a consultant on everything from suspensions to drivetrains for other companies, and this could be them reaching out and saying, "Hey, look, we can do an entire vehicle here. We can do an engine of our own, and this is what we can do for you." And this could still be something that is just kind of a study, although it looks awfully polished from the pictures and the amount of
Yes,
information they're
it
giving.
looks like it's more than a study. And if you look at Lotus in the past few years, it's been very aggressive, not only in expanding into other markets, but also into coming out with new models. Obviously in Europe, it's much more well known and sells a lot more units. But it pushed back into the U.S. With the Elise,
Amen
and
for that.
amen for that. And the Europa was a new model. So basically, they have a two-model lineup, right? With tons and tons of variations on each model. Track versions and ultra super lightweight versions and things like that. I mean, this is, I think, Lotus saying that, you know what? We don't have to stay on the fringes with all the people who are, racer boys and track fanatics. We can build a car that takes all of the Lotus kind of brand image, lightweight, excellent handling, unbelievably quick, and we can put it in something that's practical and useful. And if we do that, maybe we can sell, more units of this than the rest of our lineup combined.
Well, yeah, I
So,
mean, obviously this would have a lot more appeal if they could price it
if they could price it,
in the range that it would need to be. The other thing,
I was
oh,
just going to
sorry, go
ask what would you pay for this?
ahead. Well, I mean, it's hard to say because if you look at the interior, I mean, it's gorgeous. And it's, we're not looking at something that's inexpensive. I would guess, that you would probably be paying over a comparably sized vehicle from a standard mainline manufacturer like say Ford, with like a Freestyle. I can't even believe I'd be using those words in the same sentence.
This would be priced
Probably,
well above a Freestyle.
yeah, like a $10,000 premium or
Yeah.
something. It does have the look of where it kind of appears to be a Mazda 3, and it almost from the front looks that same size, but this is actually a much larger vehicle than that.
I'd pay 40 for this.
I mean, we'd have to see. I don't know. I mean, the other thing is that the APX is built on their new upcoming lightweight chassis that's used in their or supposed to be used in their mid-engine super sports car, quote unquote, which is likely a Esprit replacement. So this could be just them again flexing how versatile that their technology and their platforms can be.
Well, and if they're trying to get the economies of scale down for producing a supercar, this would be the best way to do it, is to build a much more mainstream vehicle that they can, have the factory going overtime to keep capacity up. So we don't know that much about it. I mean, it's still a concept, so it's hard to talk about production. But if they came out with a vehicle like this, I think with the Lotus name and the Lotus engineering, I think they could, if they could price it for as low as 40, maybe they're not thinking higher than that.
I wouldn't even be surprised if they're thinking 45 or 50.
Once you get up there, then I'm not interested anymore. But
Yeah,
40, I'm with you.
because then I'm looking at the Elise in the showroom and going, those kids
Exactly.
can, they can stay at home.
Yeah, they don't need to go to soccer practice. But it'll be interesting to see. Now, the Geneva show press days are just in a few days, and we're gonna have our one of our Autoblog Spanish correspondents is gonna fly across Europe and attend the show for us, Alberto, who was actually in Frankfurt with us. So we have more than enough faith in him that he'll cover it well, and we'll have all the coverage that we can get to as fast as possible from the Geneva show. So this will be one of them.
Yeah, he's definitely got a lot of work to do. There's,
he does.
There seems to be a ton of stuff floating out, and I mean, there we may have already seen just about everything that's supposed to debut there, but even still, just to get all of that covered, he's going to need some comfortable shoes.
Yes, he will. I wish him luck because it won't be easy. He's going to be by himself, but that's what he does. So he'll either run ragged or he'll survive, and all life will go on. But we'll have to wait and see. So that's going to be, I think, Tuesday is when that happens. So I'm going to be sitting in front of my computer all day Tuesday waiting for word from him, and we're going to get it all up as soon as we can.
Oh, very good.
All right. Well, that brings the 24th edition of the Autoplog podcast to a close. And I want to thank Volvo for sponsoring the podcast, as they do every week. We appreciate it. And also remind people to visit autoblog.com to see all the posts that we put up nearly every half hour or hour, depending on how busy a day it is. But keep checking back every day while you're at work. And you can subscribe to the Autoblog podcast within iTunes by searching for Autoblog, and it'll pop right up. Or you can visit Podcast Alley and subscribe to the podcast and vote for us at Podcast Alley. So with that, we're going to end this one. And
sounds
we will
like a plan.
Yes, it does. We will see you back probably after the Geneva Auto Show starts, and we'll talk about some of the big stuff that debuted there.
All right. Take care, everybody.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.